Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And if you're trying to eat a diet that's free of wheat, sugar, or dairy, you might want to take a look at the new cookbook our guests have out today. Our guests are Chef Sean Sherman. He works as a caterer, food educator across the country through his Minneapolis-based business, The Sioux Chef. And again, Sioux is spelled S-I-O-U-X. And Beth Dooley. Beth has been a guest on the show in the past. She's the author of many award-winning cookbooks and the memoir In Winter's Kitchen. And their new cookbook is called The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. And in it, they use American fruits and vegetables, wild and foraged ingredients, game and fish. And I'm telling you, the recipes sound delicious and they look beautiful. So you're going to want to try them, I'm betting. You may have some questions for them about indigenous foods, maybe recipes. I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post on our Facebook page. I'd love to hear from you. Sean Sherman, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Beth Dooley, welcome back to you.
Oh, it's nice to be back. Thanks, Larry.
Let's start with you, Sean. How did this cookbook come about? It's an interesting story you've got to tell.
Well, I started the cookbook, or Beth and I started the cookbook a few years ago in early 2015. And I had just started my business in Minneapolis called The Sioux Chef, which was, again, S-I-O-U-X, but as a catering company. And we went on to opening up a food truck in the Minneapolis area called Tatanka Truck. And our take on the food was utilizing a knowledge of regional indigenous cuisine. So really looking at what people were eating in our regions before any other cultures, came through. And so we were primarily just cooking foods that had been here before, and we had cut out colonial ingredients, so there was no wheat flour or dairy or processed sugar, and we weren't even using beef, pork, or chicken, so we're using lots of wild game, lots of Native American agricultural products, lots of wild foods of our regions, and just keeping the food really simple and healthy, and just showcasing that no matter where you are throughout North America, there's this beautiful indigenous backbone of food systems there. And just kind of trying to create awareness of this amazing history of, indigenous food system.
And Beth, what was your role in creating the book?
First of all, Sean and I met because a friend of ours who is one of the photographers in the book called me right after going to one of Sean's dinners and said, you have to connect with this guy. He's fabulous. His food is amazing. And he needs a cookbook. So I called Sean and then I went to one of his dinners and I was so blown away. I thought, wow, I want to learn about this food. I want to cook this food. And so I'm a writer and Sean's super busy. So that's how we began to work together, was by trying to get this story down, it was really fun. It was one of the best I have to say it's the best project I've ever had. It was so much fun, and I've learned so much. And I think that's the joy of this book. It just opens your eyes in so many ways.
Well, I have to tell you, I grew up, I've done a lot of hunting and fishing in my day, and I've eaten a lot of duck and venison and Canada goose and pheasant and fish. So I was really drawn to this book.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed looking at the recipes. I've done eaten a lot of wild rice in my day as well. And I'm telling you, I have a few questions about that as we go along. Sean, tell us about the role food played in your life growing up outside Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
Well, growing up on Pine Ridge, South Dakota, which is, Pine Ridge Reservation, I think the third largest reservation in the state. And it's been a very poor area pretty much since its inception. So when I was growing up, I should have had a lot more indigenous foods, but because of just how, things went down when people were put on reservations, we lost a lot of our foodways. So I grew up with more government commodity foods, and we just really wanted to make a change about that. Because we had some pieces that were still utilized growing up. So we had things like a wild prairie turnip called Timsala. We utilized a lot of chokecherry, and we hunted a lot. But, you know, there should have been a lot more knowledge about it. So that's kind of what really set us off to try to, you know, put this first book on paper to kind of open up people's eyes about indigenous foods and all the different diversity there is throughout Native America, and just all the health that comes through this style of cooking.
Well, you know, and as you say somewhere in the book, I mean, this is a diet that should appeal to all kinds of people.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, I mean, I mean, it's low glycemic. It's great fats. It's lots of seeds and nuts. It's super hyper local. You know, celebrates a lot of heirloom agricultural pieces. And it's just really kind of an ideal diet that really just speaks of the region you're from.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Let's talk about more about the staples of an indigenous kitchen. What are where do we get these ingredients?
Oh my gosh, you know, they're way more accessible than people think. This is, and that was again the fun of the cookbook. It opened my eyes to everything that's right outside my kitchen door. And I live in Minneapolis, so Sean and I were testing a recipe for one of the cedar braised bison recipes, and I said, "Oh gosh, I forgot to pick up cedar." And he looks at me and points out, you know, the back of the kitchen window. And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I've got cedar right outside. It's growing on the trees." And then, you know, same thing with juniper. I've got a hedge of juniper outside my front door. So, you know, we have dandelion and purslane, you know, in our you know, our backyards that I give kids money to dig out. I should be eating them greens. So there's so much, you know, I have rose hips from the roses that grow, you know, right along my fence. So there's all kinds of things that it opened my eyes to. But that said, I know that not everybody has access, for instance, to rabbit. So we did also provide alternatives that are more easily found in the grocery store for some of the foods that might be hard to find. So we're trying to make this, I would call this book kind of a gateway book into a true indigenous diet. Every recipe is completely clean, and there really is no flour and no processed sugar and none of the colonial ingredients. But in cases where there might be meats that you would hunt, if you don't know a hunter, then, you know, you can substitute another meat for it, you know, beef or bison, for instance, but only in very rare cases.
Yeah, and of course, we're right in the midst of the 9-day deer gun season here in Madison Wisconsin, so there's going to be a lot of venison.
I've never had trouble getting venison, let's just put it that way. So, not in this state anyway.
Sean Sherman and Beth Dooley, our guests today, they are co-authors of The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. And I don't think I've given the phone number yet for you to call in. Maybe I did, but I forgot about it. Let's give it again. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Call in about perhaps your experiences with indigenous food, questions you might have about indigenous foods are about using local seasoned foods. 800-642-1234. Well, there are some things. Well, first, maybe we should talk about how the book's organized, just so as a starting point. You want to talk about that, Sean?
What was the question? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just looking. Or maybe. Maybe I'll have Beth do it. Beth, go ahead.
Sorry.
Right. Well, again, Sean and I talked a lot about this, and, you know, we tried to follow both how people find food and how they present a meal. So the first, it's organized by really how we might serve things in our kitchens today,
yep,
as well as how you find things seasonally. So the first chapter is fields and gardens, and in that we have a lot of small plates, a lot of salads, and a lot of side dishes. And then we move on to prairies and lakes, where we have a lot of the fish recipes and then some of the heartier vegetarian recipes. So that's where a lot of the wild rice and the timsala as well as the fish live.
Yeah.
And then we go into, and then we also have a number of the meat recipes in there as well. So that's really more of a entree-driven chapter.
Right.
That's also where we have some of the hunted meats and the rabbit and duck and goose and things like that. And then we go into nature's sweets and teas and refreshing drinks. So, you know, even though you know, it's not a dessert-heavy book by any means, but there are a lot of really fabulous end-of-the-meal sweets that you can make without using sugar or flour, which, you know, is the basis of every European dessert. So, but yes, you can have these amazing corn cookies and these beautiful amaranth bites and this gorgeous, you know, raspberry sorbet or even a corn sorbet or a wild rice sorbet. And they're really lovely. They're not overly sweet, and yet they're a really nice way to end a meal. And in that chapter, too, we have a lot of the teas that are just, you know, mint tea and cedar tea and, you know, Labrador tea and these, you know, beautiful drinks. So, and then at the very end, we have a guide to the indigenous pantry, and those that chapter has in it different kinds of flours that you can either buy online or you can make at home. And we made a number of those different flours in my kitchen without too much trouble, things like wild rice flour or hazelnut flour or squash flour. Those kinds of things are really lovely to have on hand to finish a soup or to finish a stew or even to make into a cookie or to add to a pancake or something. And then we have, you know, in the indigenous pantry, we have a guide to stocks and how to puff wild rice, how to dry different fruits and vegetables. So those kinds of things that you can stock your pantry with that, you know, are kind of nice to draw on.
And right at the end or near the end, you mentioned wild rice, which plays a prominent role. And actually, Tom in Iowa has a question about wild rice, I believe, or a comment at least. Let's go there. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a great experience myself. I had a chance to go racing in northern Minnesota. And anything you can talk about wild rice, and I also brought cans of it to a family gathering, and people didn't know what to do with it. And then one other question is, how does fry bread fit in this, or does it?
Yeah.
Great question.
Yeah.
Sean, that's yours.
Yeah, that's Sean's question for sure.
Yeah. You know, because, well, let's start with fry bread. You know, growing up on Pine Ridge, we did eat a lot of fry bread because it was really kind of introduced into the culture. But when we started decolonizing the diet and removing pieces that weren't there, that one falls off right away because of the lack of wheat flour. And it's really kind of a food that was taught by the native people from the government and from people like showing them what to do with these government subsidies, like government supplies, like wheat flour and lard and salt and sugar. And it really became more of an oppression food in the very beginning days, towards the late 1800s. But we just, you know, talked about, so like when we did the Tatanka truck in Minneapolis and we opened up a really cool Native American food truck and we served no fry bread, we didn't know if we were going to make everybody mad or what was going to happen. But, you know, we just told people right away, like, you know, we're serving only healthy indigenous food. And, you know, taking the fryer out was the first thing we did on that truck. And there's just so much more to explore. And there's no reason that fry bread should identify every single tribe across, you know, the U.S. and Canada, because there's, you know, 567 tribes in Canada, or I mean, 634 in Canada, 567 in the U.S. And there's just an immense amount of diversity that's really kind of showcases regionality when you're looking at the different foods. So we just really wanted to showcase like all these other staples and where there was agriculture, all these beautiful products that were out there. And, you know, everybody was utilizing this immense knowledge of wild foods in all these different regions and these very simple cooking techniques and the drying and rehydrating of foods. So it's all there. And then, you know, for wild rice, it's just such a beautiful staple that's so rare that we have in our small area, because it really just grows in this Wisconsin, Minnesota, and a little bit in Canada kind of area. So it's this little blip on the global scale of where this true wild rice grows. And it's so completely different, as you might know, than the black wild rice that you might find like in a rice-a-roni mix or something like that. Because it's just this unique staple that, you know, is so valuable. And, you know, it's we're lucky that we have that staple in this region.
And, you know, wild rice that you traditionally can go to the store. I can go to Woodman's grocery store, for example, and I can get a bag of wild rice, and it's it is not like the rice that you're talking about in the book for some reason, because you say it doesn't take very long to prepare. And I'm thinking, I wonder if I can use a pressure cooker on wild rice to speed the process up.
Yeah, well, if you're using the black wild rice, then that's the paddy rice. That's the rice that was designed to grow in rice paddies so they can use combines and machinery. But the true, you know, the true lake wild rice that's here in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Canada is, you know, so unique because it's so much lighter. They're browns and reds and yellows and oranges and greens. And it doesn't take as long to cook as that black wild rice that everybody's familiar with. So it's just, it's completely different. And you can, you know, find some wild rice online. You can go to like the White Earth Wild Rice website or Honor the Earth. We have them all over the co-ops throughout Minnesota. And I've seen some true wild rice around Wisconsin here and there at some of the stores.
Yeah, and, you know, Red Lake has it, is shipping it as well. And finally, Red Lake has gotten really smart about its marketing of its true wild rice because it's marketing it in packages that say quick cooking wild rice because it really is. So because it does cook so quickly, it cooks in about 15 to 20 minutes, the real stuff. And, and as Sean said, you can find it in a lot of the co-ops, and you can find it packaged now from White Earth, Honor the Earth, and the Red Lake tribes are all selling it.
I tell you what, and wild rice, it appears in so many of your recipes. I looked at the wild rice crusted walleye, which I'm a huge walleye fan anyway, and I looked at that and I thought, why didn't I think of that? I had it looks great, and I bet it just tastes wonderful.
You know, and for us, it's just, you know, thinking about these recipes that are around us and utilizing these ingredients. So, you know, we make things with like rabbit and cedar and rose hips and maple, and it's all pieces you find walking around a lake. You know, you see all the ingredients right there in front of you. So it's really making this kind of hyper-regional flavor that really kind of describes and showcases these true flavors of all of our separate regions. And in the book, we utilize a lot of foods and flavors from our region, but we just really wanted to, you know, showcase that these recipes are flexible. And depending on, no matter what area you are in the U.S., you can think about the indigenous foods of that region and, you know, what people were eating there for such a long time. And, you know, if there was lots of agriculture, like those grains are still out there and beans and squash and things. And there's just so much you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Sean Sherman and Beth Dooley, our guests today. They are the author of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45 today, we'll talk about energy-efficient building, home building. So I hope you can stay with us for that. And please stay with us right now as we visit with Sean Sherman and Beth Dooley, authors of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Lots of great, wonderful recipes following an indigenous diet. So great to have them along. And again, you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Let's take another call. Jane and Madison, thank you for calling.
Hi there. This is a great show. Thank you. 25 years ago, I had a Native American cookbook, and I don't have it anymore. It fell apart. It was so old. But I went to a local city park and took my small children, and we gathered acorns from this huge old acorn tree. We took the acorns home, and following the recipe in the book, went through this very long and drawn-out procedure for making acorn flour, and we made acorn cornbread. It was the best, most fun I've ever had. And it made me feel so connected to the earth, and it made me feel so proud to be able to use a resource that's been around and that probably a lot of people don't think about.
Yeah, we have so many of them around, and it's such a cool resource that people are utilizing all over the place. And, you know, we're lucky to have all sorts of different kinds of nut trees around us that, you know, unfortunately we just don't utilize at all, even though there's so much food right around us.
Yeah.
That's a recipe for using any acorn flour in your book?
We do, actually. We've got a recipe for how to make it, and then we use it in a couple of different ways. So, yeah. And, you know, we also have a little guide to things to do with other tree things that come from trees. One of them is, it made me think of the the maple seeds, you know, the whirligig things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In the spring. Yeah, those are, they're kind of sweet. And so if you can roast them or open them up and just eat them, they're kind of bean-like and kind of sweet. So we have lots of tips and things like that for things you can find right outside your front door.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Uh-huh. Thanks a lot for calling. Leslie and Rhinelander up next. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning, everybody. I actually met Shami. It was with a lot of people at the Native American Nutrition Conference over in Minnesota about 2 months ago. And it was fantastic. There were about 43 tribes that came to the conference. And I grew up in New England, but also in Hawaii. So I'm what they call Hapa Hali, and my daughter is a Carib Indian. And I've been connected with indigenous foods and nature my entire life. And one of the what I love, what's happening and taking, Sean, thank you so much, because in here in this country, it's about Native Americans really, coming together now and bringing this forward for their own people, but also for all of us that are involved with this. And one of the things that you too is that you talk about is, because I collect like sumac and I make cooling teas.
Yeah.
But a lot of the indigenous foods all over, it's a universal theme everywhere that you go in the world, is that, not you call diet, but they're so nutritious for you because of all the, vitamins that are in this, and there's a reason why you utilize this. And then also the connection to nature, just getting us back out there again.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
seeing what has always been there for thousands of years and reconnecting to that. I think it's fantastic, and I do this where I am, and I grow a lot of like the pawpaws and the cranberries, and I've got the sumacs, and that connection, which I think is so vitally important for all of us, and it's a knowledge that we can then impart to our children and our grandchildren. So I just wanted to acknowledge you for this, because it's number one, what you're doing is fantastic, and I highly, in fact, tomorrow, I'm celebrating with Native American foods. All of
great.
You have in your cookbook and trying them out. So
great.
I just want to acknowledge the both of you because it's just fantastic what you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Leslie, by any chance, are you
thank
trying
so
this the salad of griddled squash, apples, wild greens, and toasted walnuts?
Yes, I am. And cedar braised beans and Three Sisters mash and maple sage roasted vegetables and blue corn mush. Yum. That's awesome. That's great.
I tell you what, when I first got the book, I just opened it up to a page, and I opened it right up to salad of griddled squash, apples, wild greens, and toasted walnuts. And I said, oh, sold me. That sounded really good. Oh, Leslie, thank you so much. And you mentioned the word, Leslie mentioned the word diet, and I had trouble using that word because I didn't want people to think that this is a diet book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not a diet book. It's really
and
not.
I didn't know what other word to use off the top of my head, but I meant diet in the other way, in a normal diet.
Well, thanks, because that was always present as, we worked through all this. This is, it's really just clean eating, but it's delicious. And I think the other thing that makes this book so different from other books in the genre is that Sean's food is absolutely exquisitely beautiful. So you could sit down and have his plates at a 5-star restaurant any place in the world, and yet it's so easy to bring into your kitchen because it's so simple.
Yeah.
So, it really kind of, it covers a lot of bases.
And I'm so happy that you used you have this wonderful photography, which really is a great example of what you just said.
Yeah.
I mean, they're beautiful dishes.
Yeah.
And, Beth and I were just in Manhattan last month, and we put on an indigenous dinner featuring the indigenous foods of Manhattan at the James Beard House.
Oh, that must have been fun.
It was really fun. And the funnest thing about it is that food was so beautiful and people were so blown away by it. I'm going to just boast because Sean's too modest. But people were just, like standing ovation, the whole thing. But what really blows me away is that Sean and Dana will go into, some of the tribal areas and serve the same food for community dinners. And it's equally beautiful. So, that I think is what makes this so special, because it has so much heart behind it. behind it. And it's so easy. I mean, that's the other thing, you know. I mean, yeah, we spent a lot of time making sure that the plates for the dinner at the James Beard House looked gorgeous, and they did. And we did a lot of different dishes. But if you were to choose maybe two or three of those dishes and do them at home, it would be the same effect.
That's wonderful. Leslie, yeah. Thank you again. I appreciate your call. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, I want to give you a chance to join in. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In the summer, I do insect photography. And
in
the summer, I'm near jewelweed patches a lot. And I've taken to, putting the seed pod in my hand, and it explodes, kind of.
Yeah.
And I've been eating those seeds. And I noticed that if you scrape them a little bit, there's like a beautiful turquoise color, very light turquoise color on them. And I wondered if you use those. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet.
We have tried them just in the wild a little bit, just playing around, because we're always so curious, and it might be a bad habit to just eat a bunch of plants while we're walking around. But, it's kind of been, for my culinary crew and I, we've just been so, interested and curious that we're always like, oh, this looks cool, and, trying to find it. And even, even hired an ethnobotanist on the team, because we felt like we're surrounded by plants all the time, and we feel like every culinary team should have an ethno or a botanist at least, and it's much easier to teach a botanist how to cook than a cook to do botany. So.
And you learned quite a bit yourself, Sean, when you worked for the Forest Service, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, definitely, because I had to, I was in the Northern Black Hills in South Dakota, and was a field surveyor, so I had to learn the names of all the plants that were up there, because I was doing field surveys throughout the season. Also with this work, we've kind of created a lifetime worth of learning, because there's so much out there, and especially now that we're focused on North America as a whole, all the way from the bottom of Mexico up through Alaska, and there's just so much diversity and region and plants and culture out there, and we're just really trying to absorb as much as we can.
Yeah. I tell you, I saw your roasted corn recipe, and then the next page, I think, or so, there was a mention in there, and you can make a stock out of the corn cobs. And I thought, well, I never thought of that before. So I immediately went to the stock page, and here's a simple way to make a corn stock.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a wild rice stock that I hadn't thought about either, where you're literally saving the wild rice, the water that you use to boil the wild rice in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that was one of the fun things about working with Sean, is that everything can become something else. So, as you mentioned, the corn stalks go, into a pot. You can make a corn stock, or you can add those to a simmering stock if you're, cooking bones down or something to make a meat stock, add the corn to it. I mean, everything has another purpose. And so, after you've cooked that wild rice and served it as a side dish, you can take whatever leftover wild rice you have, cook it down farther, and it becomes kind of mushy. And then you've got sort of a dough to make either a cookie or a patty with, and that makes a delicious pancake for breakfast, for instance. I mean, there are all kinds of, everything gets used up in a wonderful, delicious, different way. So nothing gets thrown out. And it's remarkable. And what I really loved was we were working on something, and, Sean he's so curious and so great about researching things. And so we were reading through Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden, which is a wonderful book about a Hadassah woman back in the 1800s. And she writes about taking the ash from burning the leftover corn stalks and the corn cobs and stuff to use as fertilizer. Well, that also becomes a culinary ash that's used to season things and preserve things. We'll go to New York City and get a 500-a-plate dinner, and things are garnished with culinary ash. So, some of these things have come around in the most phenomenal way.
Well, and I think there is certainly a trend of people wanting to eat local and I know a lot of people right here at Wisconsin Public Radio who never hunted, for example, who are taking it up or have taken it up because they want local food and they want something that they themselves have collected. And I think you're seeing more, seems to be a trend at least. Maybe it's just in Madison, but I don't think so.
No, it's all over, I think. Well, Sean, you've seen that when you've gone off and done dinners around the country and around the world.
Yeah, there's been a great movement, and there's a whole bunch of talented indigenous chefs. There's a bunch of them all in New York right now doing a huge dinner. So they kind of created a collective of indigenous chefs and botanists and are putting on a bunch of pop-up dinners this week to kind of celebrate, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday with the indigenous perspective.
Oh, great. Pat in Superior, we'll go to you next. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have a great way to cook wild rice.
What do you do?
Well, before you go to bed at night, you preheat your oven to 500 degrees. And in a 9x13 glass baking pan, you mix 1 cup of uncooked wild rice with 3 cups of boiling water and 1 chicken bouillon cube. You cover it and you put it in the oven and turn the oven off. And in the morning, you will have cooked perfect wild rice.
Now, I bet that's the black... Now, is that the black seed, the black rice?
No, it's the, you know, it's not the all black.
Okay, so that seems like that would be a long cooking time for that.
That's kind of like using a rice cooker. You know, we use a rice cooker all the time in the kitchen because it's easy to just, you know, brings it up to a high heat real fast and then just lets it steam out.
Ah, so that's your rice cooker.
Yeah. Rice cookers are great. Just push a button.
Well, the neat thing about it is you get up in the morning and you have this pan full of perfectly cooked wild rice.
That sounds good to me. Thank you, Pat. Appreciate your call. By the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And we have, you know, Thanksgiving is tomorrow, and you're going to have cranberries, and I see you have a cranberry sauce recipe that involves maple syrup, for one thing, and cider. And I kind of like, you use maple syrup quite a bit in your recipes, a fair amount.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it's really, we're using pure maple syrup, so not the store-bought fake stuff, but... And we use a lot of maple sugar, too, but it's just looking at, you know, natural sweeteners. So, you know, part of when we're understanding indigenous food systems, we're asking ourselves, like, you know, what were people using for sweeteners and how are they gathering salts? And, you know, there's all these questions that we kind of try to utilize. So since we're in this region, there's just so much maple around us, and it's just a big part of the staple. I mean, it's been utilized for such a long time. But, you know, in different parts of the country, we're using, you know, dried berries or agave. We're even using a lot of honey in different areas, too, even though that wasn't as widely indigenously used.
You use, and I think there's a little juniper.
Yes.
Crushed juniper in that recipe as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And we're not trying to cook like it's a timepiece. We're not trying to go back into 1491 or anything like that. We're just, you know, utilizing all of this knowledge of the past and applying it today, but, you know, kind of challenging ourselves to cook with only indigenous ingredients, because obviously people have lived here for thousands of years and didn't need, you know, dairy and wheat flour and processed cane sugar, beef, pork, chicken, and stuff like that. So we're kind of showing that it could still be done.
It's modern indigenous food.
Yeah.
Marianne.
You know,
Marianne from the Menominee Reservation up next. So let's go to her. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call.
Well, I do a recipe. We tap trees, we process our own maple syrup. We harvest the wild rice. We grow the squash. And I make a combination of wild rice with cranberries, which is certainly indigenous to the area. And then you roast it all together, and, it is so incredible. So it's everything local and gathered on our own and grown on our own. So
Sounds wonderful.
That simplicity and and all the health, you know, that comes through it.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And Amy and Osseo, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hey, hi there. First of all, I want to say I'm a huge fan. I've been following you for a little while now. I'm a chef up here in Eau Claire, and I heard you talking about some natural sweeteners. So in our kitchen, we dehydrate like parsnips and other vegetables that are super sweet, and we actually like sweet corn, and we use those for sweeteners in our kitchen.
Ah, very
good. Yeah, that's awesome.
We
use a ton of roasted squash and pieces like that too. So yeah, it's just using what we have around us and, you know, utilizing all those flavor profiles.
Oh, thanks, Amy.
Yeah. In fact, in the cookbook there. Yeah, thanks, Amy. In the cookbook, there's a recipe for roasted squash sorbet, and another one for corn sorbet. So yeah, it's really fun to use those sort of naturally sweet vegetables.
I have to admit, I did not see every recipe in the book, although I saw a good share of them. I missed that one for sure. I did see. I just lost my train of thought here for a second, but I saw a recipe for corn cakes, a simple corn cake, and then you have a bunch of toppings that you can use.
Right, right. They're wonderful. You know, they're a wonderful carrier. I mean, they're as good to use as, as any kind of bread or toast or pizza or, you know, they have so much flavor and they're really good for you.
Well, I tell you, do you guys, are you doing any presentations or appearances coming up?
Yeah, we're going to be in Duluth on Sunday at the Beaner and Coffee House at 6 o'clock.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm telling you, I'm taking your book home, and I can tell you that I once did a dinner. I was the chef for a dinner for 120 people, and I cooked 24 wild game dishes for that. Involving goose, duck, venison several ways, pheasant, walleye, pike, and...
Wow.
It was quite a treat in my farm kitchen. I can tell you that for free.
Yeah.
But
that's why I was really, another reason why I was really interested in seeing your book. And then once I saw it, this is a keeper for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, Sean, Beth, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
It's been a pleasure. Sean Sherman and Beth Dooley are authors of The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. And just a reminder, Sioux in the title is spelled S-I-O-U-X. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be back to talk with Virge Temme next about building high-efficiency homes and other buildings. Next on the Ideas Network.